Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Tonight we continue our lesson in Ecclesiastes. We're in the fourth lesson underneath the big category, Life is Unfair. We're looking at particular locations where it's unfair. In chapter 4 and chapter 5, we're going to look at six places where life just doesn't seem to be fair. There's no balance in life. And then at the end of chapter 5, we're going to enter into the beginning. Chapter 6, we'll finish it. This business on riches and money, as if that's an answer to things. Chapter 4, Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Life is unfair in six different places. In the courtroom, there we go first. Verse 1, we see this. Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of the oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them.
Is that the oppressors or the oppressed?
Both. Both had no one to comfort them. Even if you are on the side of power, you still have no one to comfort you. Okay. So the powerful and the powerless are both damaged goods. And they both cry, and they both are under the sun. The oppressor and the oppressed, and neither of them gains anything. Life is unfair in the courtroom. Keep going, verse 2. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living, who are better than the living, who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who's never existed, who's never seen the evil activity that's under the sun. Whoa. Welcome to Suicide Watch. Possible that babies who die, premature death, preemies who die, or aborted babies, or miscarried children, are in view, but I think it's more in the courtroom that he's looking. The oppressor and the oppressed sounds like a judicial business to me. So I don't think he's talking necessarily about, but he's saying, you know, it's better that you're dead because then you don't have to worry about this oppression game. And in fact, really, it's better if you never were born because then you never had to experience it. This is really sad, isn't it? And he's saying that life isn't fair if you have power, if you don't have power. I've seen it in the courtroom, and it's not a win. It's a lose-lose. The word better in verse 3 is going to be repeated three more times. It's really just the word tov, or good, but it's in contrast. It's good if you've never been born. What he's saying is it's better if you've never been born. If you are a justice bringer, and you have to deal in justice all the time, you are painfully aware of your own limitations. And the oppressor, in this case, is not necessarily one who wanted to be an oppressor. It sounds like someone who just got into it by the random nature of life and circumstances. He's wanting to be comforted because he's not sure that he made the right call. On Tuesday night, I watched an American football game. I watch a couple of them every weekend, which turns out to be our Monday, Tuesday. And I was gobsmacked at the very bad call made on the last play of the game by one of the referees. There are several officials on the field at the time. And the back judge had thrown a yellow flag indicating that an infraction had happened. But the referee came and collected it and said, nope, we're done. End of the game. Now, you look at that on any camera angle and you see the infraction had definitely taken place. There is no question of it. So I'm guessing that that referee went home and thought, I've oppressed the poor. If you will, that is, he made a bad decision, a tough call. He's got to live with it. There's no comfort for him. When you beg for justice, at the end of the night, you say, oh, yeah, that didn't work out very well. And when you demand justice, and when you have to issue justice, it's not easy. So they both need comfort, and neither seems to get it. That's what he's saying, that the courtroom is unfair. Second venue verses 4 to 8. I've seen that every labor and every skill is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity, striving after the wind. The fool folds his hand, consumes his own flesh. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, "And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure?" This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task. So we could say this is in business. So first one was in courtroom, the second was in business, down in the CBD. And we've got four different men that seem to be in view. Verse 4 talks about a man who's a competitive guy, which is what we see in every CBD, in every financial place, ever. I love the word rivalry between a man and his neighbor, kinah. This, I've seen every labor, every skill. I mean, this guy is pulling every bit of training he's had, every bit of training all his employees have. He's in a competitive industry, and he's working with his hands. He's using every bit he can. Look at him in contrast to verse 5. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. This is a collapsed man. We've got a competitive guy. We've got a collapsed guy. He's the lazy one. And Proverbs, boy, oh boy, Solomon wrote a lot about the lazy man, didn't he? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and then you might as well watch all your riches go out the window. It's Paul who wrote to the Thessalonians and said, if a man doesn't work, 2 Thessalonians 3:10. Sponge is not a good place to be. I understand it. There are circumstances that cause someone or another to be on welfare or pension or some kind of need, and that's fair enough.
Yeah.
And society is built to handle that. But when a guy who is capable is not working, Solomon calls him a fool. So he's idle, he's collapsed, he's full of rest, one hand full. Let's see. Verse 6 is the third man, isn't he? He's the contented man. One hand is full of rest. That's better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. Look at verse 6. One hand full of rest. In other words, if you've been working with one hand and then you have another hand that's resting, what's a word for that? Balance. A man who's balanced is contented. And contentment is godly and great benefit. Paul wrote that exercise is okay, but godliness mixed with contentment is awesome. It's great. It's the best. Two fists full of labor and striving after wind. This is a man who is burning the candle at both ends. He's pushing the envelope on both ends. I mean, there's no rest for him. And he says it's better to be balanced. How many hours do most people work in Australia? 40 hours a week. Joe Average pizza guy or the girl over at the dress shop, she's working 4 to 7 hours a day. And the average, we would say, is 40 hours a week. If you're in France, it's 35 hours a week. And they want less. The balance is really important. But there are people, as you say, who work 18 hours a day. Those are the guys pushing both ends and who wake up early. And Solomon wrote about that, saying it's vain to rise early and stay up late, to eat the bread of idleness, to eat nothing, to be wasting your life. So you get, at the end of the day, a lot of stuff, but you have nothing. If we average out every Australian, don't just think cities, and don't just think executives, and you go out to Tamworth, and you go to Yass, and you go to Armidale, they're working 35 to 40 hours a week. That's what people work. And if you go into a shop, I mean, here's a fascinating thing. To me, it's amazing because I'm an American and moved here, and I still am not used to it, though I guess I'm getting there. But you go to a shop at 5 minutes till 5, and they'll tell you, oh, look, we're closing in 5 minutes. Okay. And then you say, well, I'd like to see a sweater or a clock. They say, can you come back tomorrow? Now, the shopkeeper, the owner doesn't talk like that, but the employees do, because employees don't get overtime in the general retail markets. So they're sweeping. They've already cleaned up the fryer of the... They've done everything, and at 5 minutes till 5, they're ready to go. Because they get no benefits to staying late. The shopkeeper gets an extra sale, no problem, I'll stay 15 minutes. You want to stay a half hour? You want to buy another dress? You want to buy a clock? I'll be here, right? So it's a funny thing to me to watch that. Out in the country, you don't find people pushing it except in one place. farms. And they're working like crazy. By the way, I found the verse, Psalm 127, verse 2. It says, "It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors, for he gives to his beloved even in his sleep." In other words, take time off. It's okay. And what Solomon here is saying in our Ecclesiastes verse is balance, found in the one hand full of rest. No matter what you do with the other, you're going to be more balanced. That's good. And then verse 8 is this withdrawn man. There was a certain man. It's like a parable, isn't it? Verse 8. There's so much vanity. There's so much hevel, emptiness, waste in this. Now, he's looking at this circumstance in the business world, and he says there's a guy without a, we say dependent, but the Hebrew is a sheni, a second. He doesn't have a number two. He doesn't have an associate. He's all alone. He's withdrawn away from people, and he's got neither a son nor a brother, so he has nothing to leave to anyone, and no one to really walk it out with. His dad might be around, his uncle might be around, but a brother is something different than a father or somebody of that generation. And he has no son in the next generation. So he's a lonely guy. I get it. But there's no end to all his labor. He's pushing all the time. And that's what he's doing in the business world. And then his eyes were not satisfied, so he never stopped getting more. He's an accumulator. And he never said, "Why am I laboring? Why am I doing this? Why am I getting up so early, working all that? Why don't I go out to the golf course and not try to make a deal with some guys at the 19th hole? Why don't I just go out and have a nice dinner?" Nobody says I have to keep working. It's vanity. He's pushing. So there's the competitive guy in verse 4. It might be his cousin in verse 8. Either way, I think there are four different fellows that he's looking at. But in the business world, life is unfair. Third place is in what I call the highways, verses 9 to 12.
Safety in numbers.
That's it. They often quote verse 12 in weddings.
Yeah.
So I say this is life is unfair on the highway, on the traveling, in your walk of life. So it's not necessarily in the courtroom or in the marketplace, the business world. It is in your travels. Two are better than one. They've got a good return for their labor. So on the way, it says, if either of them falls, one will lift him up. So obviously, if two are walking down a path and one falls over, somebody else can pick him up. And if you're alone, nobody's going to pick you up. So
exactly.
There you are. I mean, you've experienced this. When you fall over, if no one's there.
No. Lay on the floor for 10, 11 hours.
Yeah, until your super came in. Yeah.
My village manager came to save.
It's a horrible thing.
Horrible feeling.
This is a horrible thing. And so the writer of Ecclesiastes tells us it's better to be together with someone. So what do they do nowadays? They have these, verse 11, two are better than one in bed. Of course, this is before electric blankets, but how can one be warm alone? He says life is unfair in that regard as well. And then in verse 12, it looks like a battle. If one can overpower him who's alone, two can resist him. So in all our circumstances as we travel around, it's better, two is better than one, even when we're just walking. In fact, verse 6, one hand full of rest is better, there's the tov, than two fists full of labor. And then here in verse 9, two are better than one. So again, the third reference to what things are better. Most people would agree with that, and yet, even if you had the best thing, it's still not fair. The fourth place where life is unfair, and this will surprise you, in the king's palace, verses 13 to 16. So here's a prophecy, if you will, by King Solomon of his children. And what's going to happen with this one and that one, Rehoboam and Jeroboam, who are going to battle over Judah and Israel. It's going to split the economy. It's going to split the geography. It's going to split the loyalty of the people of God from then on. We are never united again. So he's predicting that. So he's got this young wise lad who's better than himself, the old foolish king. That's what he's saying about it, himself. He's old and foolish. So this is the fourth better that's found in our text.
So the young wise lad is Jeroboam.
Yeah, poor yet wise lad.
Mm.
He's better than the old king. Well, how does he describe himself? Old,
foolish,
and doesn't receive instruction anymore.
Because when he got older, he was idolatrous.
Yeah. What's the best description of a fool is someone who won't learn. A wise man is not someone who knows everything, but who's willing to learn. For he's come out of prison to become king, and that's certainly what his son did. even though he was born poor in his kingdom. That's a surprise. I've seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. This thronging, what a great verb, to throng. It is to jump ship and to hang around. It's like we use the term sycophant. Sycophant, you might say. A sycophant is a yes man. Someone who comes to the person in power or the celebrity or the great cricketer and says, ooh, 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 I'm going to have a photo with him. I'm his best friend. Whatever he says, I'll go do. I'll accomplish whatever you need me to do. Boss, you know, I'll go do it. And there is never a correction coming out of the young against the one to whom he's a sycophant. So that's really the characterization. In the king's palace, when there are sycophants, that's not useful. And then there's this young lad, and then there's this second lad, and there's no end to the injustice and justice that's yet to come. This is striving after wind, and it's Hevel. So even where you'd think justice would happen, political justice, economic justice, even there, where the king, who should be above all that, is not above all that. Number 5 is chapter 5, verse 1, the fifth place where life is unfair. In the temple of God. Chapter 5. 1-7. In the temple of God there should be fairness and justice and rightness. And life is unfair there as well. He gives some advice about doing things appropriately, because otherwise you're going to be in trouble. He says in verse 1, when you go to sacrifice, go to listen rather than to make a big show of it. People who do that big show are doing evil, he says, and that is hiding it. Guard your steps. I think when people enter a house of God, and when I say that, of course, in those days it meant the temple, the holy temple that Solomon had built. But we can, by inference, conclude that any place that's dedicated to the Almighty should have a sense of reverence associated with it on entry.
What about if you enter a Hindu temple or a Buddhist temple or an Asian God's temple? Do you still have to have that same reverence?
I had an awkward experience in answer to your question when I went to Singapore some years ago and went from my neighborhood into, just behind me, it was Katang, I went into a Hindu temple. I'd never been in one. And I took my camera, as I do, and was happy to go shoot some photos. And I thought, I don't think the Apostle Paul would be shooting photos in here. I think he'd be declaring, you pagans, come out of your sinfulness. Or the Apostle John would say, love one another and you're falling short, and believe in Jesus. You know, John never said repent. The Apostle John never said repent. He said believe. We studied the whole book, 21 chapters. We never heard the word repent.
But Jesus said repent.
Yeah, but not in John. So he said believe, believe, believe. So I think, is here I am in this beautiful temple dedicated to false gods, that if I were an apostle, I should be doing something other than taking photographs. There is a sense of compliance when you go into a place, whether it's the Baha'i temple in Ingleside or you go into a Buddhist temple. You have to take off your shoes. You have to honor them. But you don't have to do the lucky thing. Well, I was in Thailand, Patty and I. We were on this tour with a private tour guide. It was wonderful. And she said, here, and gave me a couple sticks and said, just throw those down there in front of the Buddha and it will bring you good luck. And I said, no, thanks. Oh, no, you really? No, should. You should. It's okay. And I said, no, it's not okay. That is worship, and I'm not going to do that to a false god. All that to say that reverence is appropriate towards people and what they respect. I think that's appropriate. Look, some Christians wouldn't go into synagogues back before 1900 because, you know, that was where the synagogue of Satan was, and that was where demons were. Were they right or wrong? I think they should have gone in, maybe taken photos. I think they should have had some kind of respect for people whose religion they don't maintain. At the same time, they didn't have to bow or do anything Jewish, as a Jew doesn't have to bow or do anything Christian when he goes into a Christian place. But I think that if they ask you to do something that is too much, then don't do it. I remember when we were in Israel in 1983, and the tour guide was so funny. He kept showing us these churches, and out front of these churches were beautiful portals that were obviously designed back you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But you could see new layers of stones added at the top of the archway so that you had to lower yourself to go in. And in the olden days, I mean way old, in medieval times, they would have horses that could ride through things. And so a man who was stately could ride into a building of a tall archway. He said, this is our Jewish tour guide said, well, yeah, but they wanted you, you know, when you go into the church, they wanted you to bow your head and give obedience to Jesus. And that's why they made these archways lower. It was a very interesting perspective, whether it's true or not. The temple of God should be a place of fairness. There was some sacrificial problem here, the sacrifice of fools. Verses 2 and 3, the prayers that are random, the Hebrew mahar, hasty, is also the same word that's used for impulsive. Don't be speedy in word or speedy in thought. Wait a minute, aren't you supposed to think quickly? Yeah, but what he's saying is, don't be in too big of a hurry to let God know everything. Calm down, pace yourself, humble yourself, and he'll lift you up. The Hebrew word for word is your mouth. Don't be in a hurry in your mouth or in a hurry in your heart. Lev, to bring up a matter in the panim of God. God's in heaven, you're on the earth, shut up. That's what I wanted to say. A dream comes through much effort, the voice of a fool through many words. So don't talk a lot. That's what he's saying. And specifically in relation to prayer in the Holy Temple. And specifically then he switches in 4 to 7 and talks about vowing. And this definitely informs Yeshua about make no vow at all. That's what Yeshua said in the Gospel, in the Sermon on the Mount. And again, now we get to the 5th or 6th Tov in 5:5. It's better that you shouldn't vow than you should vow and not pay. Pay what you vow in verse 4. Don't let your speech, there again is the word mouth, cause you to sin. And don't say in the presence of the Malach, the angel of God, that it was a mistake. Oops, I didn't mean that. Because you're going to be judged. Why should God be angry, Al Hakol, because of your voice and destroy all the workings of your hands? Many dreams, there's many words, there's emptiness, so fear God. So prayer is not a thing to take lightly. Vowing, you're going to mess up. Life is unfair. Just don't do it wrong. Pay correctly. Pay your vows. Make a vow, pay it. If you hire somebody, don't say, come back tomorrow, I'll give you then, if you've got it with you. That verse from the Proverbs informs me so much that at the end of every Friday, I'm paying my bills. In fact, I get a bill in the post. I want to pay it that day, but I generally wait till Friday and do it all at once, open my internet, pay bills. It's so different than we used to do it. But clear my bills, clear my payments, so that I have no one whom I'm shortchanging. Pay what you vow. Then I'm going to say the next section, the next place where we're supposed to do right and try to live fairly is in Town Hall, verses 8 and 9. It's actually better if the king is involved and if justice is meted out well. But if you see something wrong, don't be surprised. Unfairness happens. Life happens. Bad calls happen. Verse 8, if you see the oppression of the poor and denial of justice, don't be shocked. This happens. It's not the best. And in fact, there's going to be someone to whom that guy answers. For instance, in that football image that I started with, there are league officials dealing with that now. They have to deal with that. There are referees. And there are league officials who are beyond and above referees who have to then decide things. I mean, we saw that in the National Rugby League this year, where some rugby league official was canned. Boom, gone, fired, dismissed because of several bad calls in one game. You just got to do that. But don't be surprised, is what he says.
There was a guy that was sentenced to 4 years jail after killing a boy with a punch. He whacked him, the victim died, and he was charged with something lesser than manslaughter, and it said, give you only 4 years, but the family are rising up and they're all giving protests, marching here and there. They're asking the government to erase their justice system, and forever a first punch is held, they want to make it manslaughter.
The example is a good example that says, if somebody to whom you go for justice in town hall or the magistrate's court doesn't exactly give you what you want,
yes,
there might be an appeal process that's higher yet. So if life is imbalanced and therefore unfair, where might it be more balanced? And the first port of call that almost everybody goes to, certainly in these days, is money. your wallet. So we begin in chapter 5 and verse 10 with what people think money will do. So I'm going to read 10 to 20. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is hevel. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what's the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment and he'd fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He'll take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what's the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, great sickness, and great anger. Here's what I've seen to be good and fitting. To eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he's also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness. There it is again, simchat libo, the gladness of his heart. Money looks like it ought to work, except it doesn't. Four places where it doesn't. We're going to go on with more of those next week as we do chapter 6. But tonight we'll finish with chapter 5, this business of money not working. In verse 10, we see that money does not satisfy. Whoever loves money won't be satisfied with money. He who loves abundance will not be satisfied with its income. In the Proverbs he said, riches makes itself wings and flies away. Chapter 23. Paul the Apostle wrote to Timothy, his young charge, and said, for the love of money is the root of all evil. It's not money that's the problem, but what does he say?
Love.
He who loves money. I mean, that's clearly the informer to the Apostle. Is this text in Ecclesiastes, the Ohev Kesef, Lo Yisbak, he will not be satisfied, Kesef. I love that. If you will, it's sort of like parentheses. You love money, you're not satisfied with money. You think this will work, forget about it. That's not it. And you'd think, well, wait a minute, that ought to work, because I've seen the rich guys, and they seem to have it all together. Life is unfair. The rich guys have it, and I don't have it, and if I just had it, I'd be all right. No, because the one who loves abundance, the one who has all these things, I love it. The full stomach, verse 12, of the rich man doesn't allow him to sleep. The guy who has everything overeats, because he overindulges. You think that money is satisfying, verse 10. That's not true. You think, verse number 11, that it's going to solve your problems. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. In other words, if I could just get more stuff, it'll fix the problems of my day. You remember Tevye, who said, look, it's not great to be rich. If I were a rich man, you know, he said, I'd love it. It's no great honor to be a poor man either. Yeah, this notion of having stuff is so endemic in the world. This accumulation of stuff by the which we think we're going to be benefited and benefiting others. It is a trap. Every day this week on several radio and TV stations, they're giving away money. I don't understand.
Even on the internet. Chance to win a car, chance to win this, chance to win holidays, cruises, and all that.
Yeah, it's the appeal of satisfaction and contentment that surely if I had $10,000, I would be more content. No, I'd just have more stuff. I don't know that I'd have more contentment. I'd have more trips. I don't know that I'd be happy when I traveled there. I'd have more cars. I don't know that when I got where I was going in that car that I'd be happier. That's what he's saying. It's not going to solve your problem.
Yeah.
Verse number 12, that it brings contentment. We know this is not true. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. So if you got a regular job, you can go to sleep and it is a blessing. You are matok. Yeah, whether he eats little or much. In other words, what you have on the table is not going to make you happier. It's whether you've had a reasonable job and you're content in your life. Let me get that verse for contentment. It's 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6. Godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. Godliness is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. Just reading a little something here. There's a positive life view that emerges from the book that may be called a theology of contentment in view of the lack of substance and meaning in life. Kohelet, that's the preacher, urges his readers to enjoy life, for it is God who gives us that privilege. The satisfaction does not belong to all mankind, for the work of the sinner ends in futility. Godly contentment, this author says, is not the ultimate good for mankind. Oh. Kohelet reminds us of a future time when God will bring all things into judgment. This is the conclusion of his search for meaning in life. One is reminded of the counsel of the Apostle Paul in view of the futility of life. He looked away from life's meaninglessness to his future redemption. And the fourth thing that money can't buy, 13 to 17, is security. Because the guy has his riches, but they're lost, either through a bad investment, or after he fathers a son, there's nothing to support him. In other words, the kid takes all his money. He came naked from his womb, he's going to go back there, so, you know, why do you bother with a great accumulation package? That's not going to give you security. Stuff doesn't give you security. So how does he end? He says this in verse 19 and 20. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he's also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and to rejoice in his labor. That's the gift of God. So work. Work. It won't kill you. In fact, it'll kill you if you don't. If you got stuff and you're guarding it because others are going to come in and take it, you know what'll happen? They'll take it. Whether it's the government or your kid or... So really, if you do that wealth thing, verse 20 says, you won't often consider the years of your life because God keeps him occupied with the simchat libo, the pleasures, the gladness of his heart. That's really where we need to be. That's where God is calling us to a fairness that's based on who he is, not on what we've got or where we are or what other people have. You keep that right and you'll be right.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.